Gregory Warner here to tell you about NPR's new international podcast. It's called Rough Translation. Each week, we're going to take you to a different country to hear a story that reflects back on something that we are talking about here in the United States. Maybe get a perspective shift. Travel with us. Rough Translation is on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I first met 26-year-old Uciel Romero at a plant store near my apartment in Harlem.
I'm a succulentologist now. I have so many succulents, it's not even funny.
Uciel was born in Mexico and brought to the United States as a 9-month-old baby. And he'd been living in the United States without papers until 2012, when he got DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And DACA gives temporary protection from deportation to people like Uciel.
It was a huge relief because now I'm able to work anywhere, at least get a normal job and not just work manual labor and just be okay and not to have that behind my head everywhere I walk.
Because Uciel has legal permission to work here, at least for now, I was surprised when I got a text from him the other night.
And all I saw was I had been taken by the Border Patrol.
Yes, I tried to text as fast as I could.
Uciel and his brother were about to board a bus in upstate New York, which is a trip Uciel takes often. But on this day, Border Patrol agents were interrogating passengers.
I wasn't fearful of it because I have DACA.
The immigration agents asked if he was a U.S. citizen.
I told him no. I told him that I am DACA. He said, show me your ID. Showed him the ID, and it's a work authorization card. I thought that was sufficient enough for at least the status to permit me to be here in the United States.
But the agents wanted to see the letter of approval for DACA that he had gotten in the mail. And Uciel didn't have that letter on him. So they loaded him into the back of a patrol car.
And I told Zolo, I think my family's at home. I think they can look through my files and they can take a picture of it and just send it towards me, to my phone. But they said that if there is nothing to verify, we'd have to start proceedings of removal out of the country.
About 5 minutes later, his mom sent him a photo of his DACA letter. The agent typed his information into a computer and told Uciel he was free to go. But he said, always carry that copy of your letter because you never know when you'll be stopped again.
Do I have to look over my shoulder again? Do I have to have that in my mind?
More than 750,000 people have DACA. And like Uciel, they had felt protected. But 6 months into President Trump's term, things are changing fast. And not just for people with DACA.
Millions of undocumented immigrants who weren't a priority before are now at risk of deportation.
That's Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri. And she'll be co-hosting with me
as we spend the whole hour asking not just has anything changed under the new administration regarding immigration, but what those changes look like in real life.
But first, a little bit of history. ICE, the agency, is actually pretty young. It was formed as a direct response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Before 9/11, immigration was handled by the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. It was more of a bureaucratic civil office. Today's ICE agents are using cop-like practices, down to bulletproof vests with the word police on them.
This type of immigration enforcement was a major theme of President Trump's campaign.
And since he's taken office, there are three main things that have changed.
Number one. On January 25th, during his first week in office, President Trump signed an executive order that expanded, quote, priorities for deportations.
Here's what this means. Under Obama, immigrants without criminal records were not prioritized for deportation. But Trump's order rolls this back. ICE Director Thomas Homan put it this way.
If you're in this country illegally and you committed a crime but entered this country, you should be uncomfortable, you should look over your shoulder, and you need to be worried.
Number two. Last month, Homan emphasized the need to crack down on sanctuary cities, which are cities that refuse to cooperate or limit their cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And Homan announced the hiring of 10,000 new ICE agents.
In a sanctuary city, an undocumented immigrant might feel more comfortable reporting a crime to police because they trust that cops are not going to immediately contact ICE. But across the country, police departments are noticing a sharp drop in reports by Latino victims of rape and domestic assault. Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo says reports are down 43% this year.
When we lose the hearts and minds and the trust of 11 to 15 million potential victims and witnesses, all Americans lose.
Number three, according to the latest numbers from ICE, arrests have skyrocketed under the Trump administration, up by 35%.
When all these policy shifts come together, expanding priorities, cracking down on sanctuary cities, arresting people in courthouses, this leads to a whole lot more detentions. Camille Mackler with the New York Immigration Coalition says that ICE agents are operating with a freedom they've never experienced before.
ICE enforcement removal officers feel completely unleashed. Like they feel like the muzzle's been taken off. And that is absolutely what we've seen.
Somewhere between detentions, deportations, and temporary legal status, there's this gray area where people periodically do what is known as a check-in.
It's basically an appointment with an ICE officer to meet one-on-one. And the people going to these appointments are there for different reasons. Some are there because, let's say, ICE got wind, they've been living here illegally for a while, but they're not a priority.
Others check in because they are getting deported, and they've got one last chance to ask for more time.
Most meetings don't usually last too long. The agent checks some basic information, like is the person still living where they say they live? Are they still working and not getting in trouble with the law?
And people check in from once every few months to maybe once a year to essentially be monitored.
The deportation officer may say, you're not a threat to public safety. I'm not going to use my resources to deport you. So come back next month so that I can see that you're not trying to, you know, run away from me.
That's Camille Meckler, Director of Legal Affairs with the New York Immigration Coalition. I asked the organization to connect us with someone who was scheduled to do a check-in. So our intrepid intern, Nicole Acevedo, and I met a 50-year-old man named Martin Martinez.
We met him outside of the ICE offices here in New York City a couple months ago.
Hi.
He's here with his wife and daughter.
And what was this morning like for you? Did you sleep okay?
No, of course not. I was thinking all night, you know, and worry, you know, about what is going to happen today.
Martin has jet black hair and a matching mustache. He works as a warehouse stocker for a well-known office supply chain. He's been living in the U.S. for the last 30 years. When he came here back in the 80s, things were different. There was no border wall, no ICE, and getting here illegally was a lot easier.
Martin had two kids here in the U.S., Martin Jr., who's 27 and a new dad, and Maria, who's 22 and works for the state government in New York.
We honestly don't know what we're going to walk into.
There's a lot on the line at today's check-in. Martin has a deportation order. And last time he was here, the immigration officer told him he was scheduled to leave the country July 1st. He told Martin that he should come back today, June 13th, and bring a one-way plane ticket to Mexico.
They asked you to buy a ticket?
Yes.
With your own money?
Yes.
And did you do that?
Yes.
One-way flight from JFK to Mexico City with a layover in Orlando. And this is something that Camille, who we heard from earlier, says happens more often than people know.
You think deportation means taking somebody and putting them on the plane? Oh, no. That is the last resort. Most people who are deported are buying their own plane ticket to leave the country.
A spokeswoman with ICE said this practice is normal and it's been going on for years. At today's check-in, Martin and his family are hoping to ask for more time so he doesn't have to get on that flight.
They may tell us, you know, we'll give you extra time to stay here, or they may just say, which is a worst case scenario, you have to leave July 1st.
The reason Martin is here today, in part, stems from something that happened 20 years ago. In the late 1990s, Martin was pulled over for a faulty taillight. The police officer then noticed that Martin had been drinking, so he was charged with a DUI.
But because Martin couldn't prove he was living in the U.S. legally, he was taken to an immigration detention center where he was held for a couple of weeks, then released. A few years later, he got another DUI.
A spokeswoman with ICE said Martin went in front of an immigration judge in 2004, who said he should leave the country. But Martin appealed that decision. And in 2007, he was told he was up for deportation.
But it wasn't until 2013 that ICE came to Martin's door. Martin was told he needed to go meet with an ICE officer, That's when he started the check-ins.
Which he did in 2013, 2014, 2015, and last year. Routine visits, like we described earlier. Until a few months ago, when he was told he was now facing deportation.
He was asked to come in April, May, and June. And each time, the visits became more stressful.
But still, that didn't mean he would necessarily be deported. Many people who have deportation letters end up going to these check-ins sometimes for years before anything changes in their cases. And some eventually even find a legal way to stay in the U.S. So why show up at all? Well, because if you don't show up, you're deemed a fugitive. So as stressful as these check-ins are, it's better than the alternative.
Okay, back to Martin's appointment.
We put our recording gear away and we go through security. Okay, so this place essentially looks like the DMV. It's 9 a.m. and the room is packed. There aren't two empty chairs together, so Martin and his wife sit in different rows. Maria leans against a nearby wall.
Every 10 to 20 minutes, an officer just opens a door, calls out a name, and every time this happens, the room gets quieter.
Martin is familiar with this room. He says there used to be a portrait of the president on the wall above an ICE insignia. But today, there's only a small nail on that wall. No hay foto del otro, he says, meaning that there's no photo of the other guy, Trump.
It's noon now, and the room is starting to empty out.
An immigration officer calls out Martin's name.
About 10 minutes later, Martin and his lawyer come out, and the lawyer tells the family that the ICE officer had to call a supervisor because the ticket should not have had a layover. So Maria runs out to the hallway and gets on her phone to buy a new ticket.
It's 12:45 now. The immigration officer opens the door and calls out Martin's name again. Martin and his lawyer go back in.
Not even 2 minutes go by, and the door opens again.
At this point, they're expecting one of two things to happen. Either the ICE officer says, "All right, Martin, you have to get on that flight and leave the country in 2 weeks," or "We're granting you more time to appeal your case." But when the door opens, something unexpected happens. Only the lawyer comes out. He walks straight to Maria and hands her a pair of reading glasses and a wallet. They're her dad's. The lawyer then tells Maria they took him into custody.
Coming up on Latino USA, what will happen to Martin? Stay with us. No te vayas.
Like to say a quick thank you and share a message from one of our sponsors, the United States Postal Service. If you're a small business, go ahead and dare to dream big, because when you ship with USPS, you use the same service that big businesses do. You can come out ahead just like them. When a small, medium, or large business ships with the United States Postal Service, their business becomes part of USPS. For more information, visit usps.com/tonegocio. USPS. Priority you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Before the break, we heard the story of Martin Martinez, a Mexican immigrant who's been living in the United States for 30 years and is now facing deportation. We had gone with Martin to what is known as an ICE check-in. He and his lawyer wanted to ask for more time so they could apply for other ways to let him stay in the United States legally.
We just left the ICE office. We're not allowed to record anywhere near the building. So, Nicole, let's just kind of talk through what just happened.
Martin had just been unexpectedly detained because the ticket he had bought with his own money following his deportation order had a layover. ICE requires people to buy nonstop flights out of the United States so they can be sure that the person, in this case Martin, actually leaves the country. And now, Fernanda Chavarri and Nicola Acevedo pick up the story. Right,
I mean, when we talked to them this morning, they seemed
like anxious. It seemed, yeah.
But I don't think anyone ever expected that on such a small technicality, mm-hmm. Martin wouldn't be able to go back to upstate New York with his wife today.
After Martin was detained, the family asked us to get them some space. So we left. They told us to meet them a little later at the ice holding facility where Martin was being taken. So we go inside and find Maria and her mom at the building's cafeteria.
What was going through your mind when the lawyer came out by himself and he handed you the wallet and the glasses from your dad?
I was in shock because I saw my dad's face and immediately I realized, oh my God, they are taking him in.
You could see him inside?
Yeah, I saw my dad and I saw other officers.
After her dad was detained, Maria's mom started crying. But this 22-year-old kept her cool and she went straight into fix-it mode.
I felt guilty and I felt terrible because I bought the ticket with the layover and really just a mistake, right? A mistake that anyone can make. I mean, I'm dealing with my dad potentially facing deportation and I still have to buy this one-way ticket to Mexico knowing that he's not going to come back. That's a hard thing to do.
There's something else. Martin is diabetic and he has a heart condition. So they go full force on a mission to get him out.
Maria calls politicians, advocacy groups, and reporters because she wants to get attention on her dad's case.
Now, this type of public call-out has become sort of normal in the last decade. But there is a heightened sense of urgency right now because this administration has made it a priority to deport people.
So Maria is using her Rolodex to get a press conference going. And since she's been working with local and state politicians for a while, she knows a lot of people who would show up.
While she's doing all of this, her dad is spending his first Father's Day as a grandpa in detention.
After a week of countless phone calls, emails, and public statements from politicians, Martin was released from detention.
But he's still scheduled to be deported. Being released from detention basically means that Martin can go home to be with his family for 2 weeks, but he still has to get on that plane July 1st and go back to Mexico. Camille from the New York Immigration Coalition, who we heard from at the top of the story, believes that if Martin's case had happened before the new administration,
we would have probably been able to negotiate, give us a week to come back with a different ticket, or give us even a date to come back with a different ticket that shows that we're complying.
Or in the case that I saw, give us an hour. They did come back with a ticket, but the officer just didn't want to see it at that point.
It's now June 30th. It's a Friday, the day before Martin is supposed to get on a plane. We reach out to him, but Maria tells us that her dad is upset and would rather not speak to any reporters.
So we meet Maria at a Starbucks near her office before she heads upstate to help her dad pack.
We're planning on leaving quite a few hours in advance because we have to meet with the ICE agents at the gate.
Maria bought a ticket next to her dad on that same flight. She didn't want him to be alone on the plane.
I just can't bear that thought, so I wanted to go with him and make sure that I was there during that first moment where he returned back to his country.
Maria plans to stay in Mexico for about a week and help her dad get settled. And her mom is also thinking about going to Mexico, too, because she can't imagine being without her partner of 30 years.
As for Maria and her brother, moving is not an option right now. They were born here, grew up here, have jobs here. They're U.S. citizens. What the Martinez family is going through is not new. Families all over the country have been separated by deportations under Bush and Obama. But there is a new tone coming from the White House that for Maria goes beyond immigration laws.
Honestly, yeah, I mean, the elephant in the room, we have to acknowledge it's because of Trump. And honestly, it's an act of pure racism. It's more about, you don't belong here. And it's a terrible feeling because me being a Mexican-American, I was born here, I'm caught between two things, I feel as if I'm not welcome here only because of where my family comes from.
Finally, the day arrives, July 1st.
Family and friends were at the Martinez home saying goodbye before driving to the airport.
The ICE agent had called me too, and he was very friendly over the phone. He was nice. It's like, all right, we're running about 15, 20 minutes behind, but we'll meet you at the terminal.
The agents finally showed up in a pickup truck, wearing plain clothes. They told Maria and Martin to meet them outside in the passenger pickup area and asked him to sign a few forms.
Which means that my dad is signing that, yeah, he's now in fact leaving the country and his order of deportation is now being taken into effect. What was more heartbreaking was seeing my brother say goodbye to my dad. My dad was crying his eyes out.
And your mom?
She was crying.
Martin was devastated, but felt some relief to have his daughter by his side.
The whole time I was just holding his hand and walking him to the security, you know, checkpoint.
The two arrived at the gate. The ICE officer hovered for 2 hours until they got on the plane. But before they boarded the plane, the ICE officer said something that Maria remembers very well.
He came up to us and he shook my dad's hand and said, "Mr. Martinez, have a great flight. Hopefully there's a way that they can bring you back." So he said that.
It's been a month since Martin was deported. He has been living with his brother in a small town in the Mexican state of Puebla, a place Martin hadn't visited since he was a teenager.
Maria tries to call her dad as much as possible. She usually remains positive, but a couple of weeks ago, she couldn't.
You could hear it in my voice that I was about to break down, and my dad was asking me, he was like, "Are you okay? What's wrong?" It's like, "Nothing, I just wanted to ask how you're doing." So it's been very, very hard.
Maria and her brother plan to visit their dad in Mexico whenever possible. Last week, their mom left the U.S. to be with their dad.
That Saturday afternoon at the airport, when the family was separated, passersby might have seen them and thought it was just like any other airport goodbye. People hugging and crying, but it wasn't. This was a deportation. And these are happening more than people know. Right there, between the newsstand and the security checkpoint at Newark Airport.
Our thanks to Fernanda Chavarri and Nicola Acevedo for that story. Now, Martin's experience is not what you might think about when you hear the word deportation. Someone in the seat next to you on an international flight might be getting deported and you wouldn't even know it. But before deportation, there's detention.
And since the new administration took over, ICE detentions have increased by 35%.
All right, Fernanda, but what does that percentage actually mean in terms of raw numbers?
All right, so for example, in a one-month period in December, before Trump took office, ICE detained 9,000 people. And for the month of June, that number went up to 14,000.
And when people are detained, most of them end up in an immigration detention center, which is essentially a prison.
But unlike quote-unquote prisoners, the immigrants detained do not have the right to get free legal representation. There's no, if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you speech. They're left to navigate a pretty confusing system on their own.
That's where lawyers working pro bono step in. Many of them go help immigrants in detention. And actually, there's an organization in Florence, Arizona called the Florence Project that exists solely to help immigrants in detention.
And with the number of people being detained already getting higher, I flew out to Phoenix to see exactly how much lawyers are needed. I met with Lola Bovel with the Florence Project.
This is you?
Yes, yes.
Lola picked me up at my hotel at 7 a.m. before heading down to the Eloy Detention Center, a giant building that sits about an hour and a half away.
Yeah, it's pretty isolated. I think, you know, doing the drive once, twice, and then maybe the first 6 months, it's not that bad. But I think once you start getting into the year mark, now that I've been with the Florence Project almost 2 years, it adds up.
Eloy is a small town south of Phoenix. There's really not much there. It's just a prison town. Federal and state prisons peppered throughout the desert with immigrant detention centers all around.
will do these presentations to talk about people's, what they can expect in court.
The lawyers and legal aides for the Florence Project visit detainees to talk them through the legal basics so that if they end up in front of an immigration judge alone, at least they won't be totally lost.
These big, like, poster board things that essentially have information on them, and then we talk about what are the quote-unquote rights. So, for example, the right to have an interpreter if you don't speak English, things like that.
The Florence Project staff is small, so they couldn't possibly represent all the thousands of people who are in detention, but they do help connect them with pro bono lawyers. That's a little bit of what Lola does. She's from Miami, her parents are New Yorkers from the Bronx, and she's a managing attorney with the Florence Project. Today, she has a list of about 90 names of men who want to get legal help at the Ely Detention Center. She'll likely be here for most of the day, so she came prepared.
And I have a granola bar in my bag, and I also have, oddly enough, a pizza Lunchable.
So Lunchables are A-OK. Don't bring a breakfast burrito now, but a Lunchable is cool.
I think that's actually, that's right, but Ananda, yeah.
Seriously?
When we get to the Ely Detention Center, it looks straight up like a prison. So much barbed wire. It's owned and operated by the largest private prison corporation in the U.S., CoreCivic, formerly known as CCA. There's about 1,500 men and women detained here on any given day, and all of them are in the custody of the Department of Homeland Security. And yes, there are people here who have been convicted of violent crimes, but they are the minority.
So what am I allowed to be part of as far as your day?
So you'll be able to essentially stay outside of the detention facility. You can stay in the lobby, and you can also go into hearings because those are public, as long as it's not a private hearing.
Okay, so we're here.
I guess I'll turn this off now.
Lola goes in first. She knows the guard and gets through security quickly. The guard asks me to put my belongings through a metal detector and to hand him my driver's license. He asks me why I'm there, and I tell him I'm a journalist, that I'm here hoping to sit in on some of the court hearings and just observe. He tells me I can go in, but I'm not allowed to bring anything with me. No water, no phone, not even a piece of paper and a pencil. So I sit in the waiting room for about 10 minutes, and the only other person there is a woman with her young son and baby girl in her arms. She has her wrapped up in a fuzzy pink blanket. It's freezing in this waiting room. A guard calls me and escorts me through the locked door. To my left, I see a big open room with a group of men wearing prison-like scrubs listening to the Florence Project presentation. To my right, women waiting to meet with their lawyers. After going down a couple of long, echoey hallways, the guard opens the door to another hallway and says, "We're here." It's a hallway with doors on each side. The ones on the right have gold plaques with the judges' names on them. Those are their courtrooms. A spokeswoman with the Department of Justice said that they have 58 immigration courts across the country, and 19 of them are inside immigration detention facilities like this one. The courtrooms look like what you'd expect. There's a clerk, a defense attorney, a prosecutor, and the immigration judge wearing a black robe sitting below a large seal. This one says Department of Justice. That's where I meet a man whose nephew, Jesus, has been detained at Ely for 3 weeks and is going to ask to be released on bond today. Jesus is 22 and ended up here because after a car crash, the traffic cop found out that he didn't have a valid driver's license and that he was undocumented. This is his first time here. And in less than 10 minutes, the judge decided to let Jesus out on a $12,000 bond, at least until his next immigration hearing. His uncle tells me that he's going to drive up to the nearest city to get a cashier's check for $12,000. He tells me that Jesus's parents sold a truck and cleared out their savings so they could give him $10,000. The other two are going to come out of his pocket. Lola and I meet up again in the parking lot and we drive to get food. Turns out the Lunchables weren't much of a lunch.
Just reconvened. You've been in sort of your side of the detention center at Ely.
She tells me about her day.
We had about 90 people today on the list.
And I tell her about Jesus. I also recap with her about all the hearings I saw. I sat with three different judges. Some people were asking to be let out on bond, like Jesus. Others were asking to be sent back to their home countries.
More people than I expected, actually. They were willing to self-deport just so they could get out of detention.
I mean, the way that the judge phrased it, it almost sounded like, and these are my words, like a privilege. Like, that was the vibe that I was getting, which was, because you're leaving the country in this way, you may have a better chance of returning if you ever want to apply for whatever from your home country. Did I understand that properly?
I would say so. There are generally less consequences if you're granted voluntary departure than a deport order.
As the day came to an end, I wanted to get back to Jesus's uncle to see if they were able to get him out. So I call him, and he tells me that they just left the detention center, and they're headed to an In-N-Out Burger not far from us. That's where I officially meet their 22-year-old nephew.
Jesus Gabriel Quiroz Villalobos.
Hey! Turns out the little boy and baby girl wrapped up in a fuzzy blanket I saw in the waiting room are his kids.
I was just craving In-N-Out for like the past 3 weeks.
and now here you are. What did you eat?
Double-double and some fries and a Sprite. Food in there is just rice and potatoes. It sucked. It's just depressing.
What did you miss the most?
My babies. My son is 2.5 years old and my daughter is 5 months. Honestly, there's a lot of CEOs in there that treat you really well, and they tell you that they're not better than us and they treat us like human beings. But there's CEOs in there that try to you up. Like, there's nothing but Hispanics. No, and the Hispanics are the most ones most of the time. I would ask them, I told them, I'm like, are you Mexican? I would ask them, hey, man, are you Mexican? And they'd be like, yeah, my family don't even have papers. And I'm like, how do you work here? And they said, honestly, we don't care. It's just a job. I'm like, how? Are you looking at, we're your people, man, and look where we're at. He's like, well, I don't care about that. I'm just trying to get money.
Jesus was born in Mexico and brought to the U.S. when he was 5. He's one of 3 people who were released from the Eloy Detention Center today and says that the other 2 guys also had to pay more than 10 grand to get out.
My lawyer told me that if I didn't get out today, I was going to have to do another 6 months. So I was kind of scared. It sucked. I honestly was in there lost. I didn't know. If it wouldn't have been for my lawyer, I didn't know what to answer. If you noticed, when they would ask me questions, I was so lost, I didn't even know what to say.
And this is exactly why there's such a need for legal representation and legal advice for those in immigration detention. This is why Lola does what she does at the Florence Project. As for Jesus, the plan is to show up to all his future immigration hearings and to have his wife, who's a U.S. citizen, submit the paperwork to get him a green card. Because like most people who spend time in a prison-like facility, Jesus says he never wants to end up in detention again.
Thanks again, Fernanda, and we'll hear back from you a little bit later in the hour. And a quick side note. For the last 4 months, we've been requesting a ride along with ICE agents out in the field to hear directly from them. But ICE hasn't given us a date yet. Coming up on Latino USA, we go to a city in Texas that's suing its own state over immigration. Stay with us. No te vayas.
A quick shout out to one of our sponsors who brings you this message. Casper, a sleep brand that offers obsessively engineered mattresses, featuring Casper's supportive memory foam for just the right sink and bounce. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit. So try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Latino and use promo code Latino.
Thanks for listening to Latino USA. This summer, keep up to date on the day's news with Up First. It's the morning news podcast from NPR. In just 10 minutes, Up First gives you the quick morning update on what happened and what you need to know to start the day. Wake up with Up First tomorrow morning on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Pikayarka, tu kuyas una kunapa, asi, yaki, causa, guani, rumi kunawa, churu kunawa.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As immigration enforcement ramps up, it's not just immigrants who are affected. many local police departments depend on a neighborhood's trust. But an increased ICE presence in an immigrant community can sometimes make it harder for the police to do their job. One place where tensions between law enforcement and ICE are reaching a boiling point is in El Paso, Texas. I wanted to find out exactly what this looks like, so I went there. That's where I met reporter Jonathan Hirsch, and we immediately took a drive.
Okay. So that, like, right there,
Yeah. That's
like the border.
Yeah, we're right alongside it.
We're driving towards downtown El Paso, and the border fence actually hugs the interstate. Just beyond the fence, Ciudad Juarez. This is typical El Paso. You can't go more than a couple of blocks in this city without being reminded of its location, always by Mexico's side, so much so that it's hard to tell where one begins and the other ends.
El Paso is mostly Latino, nearly 80% Latino, and roughly 1 in 5 El Pasoans identify as foreign nationals. So even if you're not undocumented, you're likely to know somebody who is, or somebody who's living here under a tourist visa. That's partially because Ciudad Juarez is a major trading partner with El Paso. Many live on one side of the border and work on the other.
And like all other things in El Paso, law enforcement plays a unique role in this border city.
How are you doing? Robert Flores. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Commander.
How are you doing? Robert Flores.
This is Commander Flores. He has an office on the second floor.
We'll go up to the office. It's a little
you have a vest on?
Yeah. I'm just a fat guy.
Flores has worked in law enforcement for over 25 years. Before we showed up, Flores was getting pumped up by listening to some of his favorite jams.
Okay, what's the music that we're hearing?
Well, I'm about to kill it.
That's like some hardcore rock.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big Metallica fan.
He's a laid-back dude. But he takes law enforcement's role as a support system within this community very seriously.
We take care of our public safety issues here. That's why we're one of the safest communities in the country. We don't have nearly the violent crime rate that other cities have.
Part of what makes El Paso so safe, Flores says, is this close relationship between law enforcement and the community. They're used to neighborhood policing, which basically means that your local police officer hangs out, gets to know your neighborhood, and generally develops bonds with the community. It's part of what makes cops good at their jobs. They can know what normal looks like. So when something out of the ordinary happens, they notice. It's built on trust. But recently, that trust has been tested by a new state law known as SB4 that requires police officers to do the job of immigration agents or face serious consequences from the state.
The bill, signed into law by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, penalizes cities whose police officers don't perform certain duties once reserved for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Like, for example, asking about a person's immigration status at a routine traffic stop. If you're familiar with Arizona's famous SB 1070 or the Show Me Your Papers law, it's kind of like that. But the thing is, many at the local level are not so thrilled about SB 4.
And law enforcement in El Paso? They say this places them in an especially tough bind.
If SB 4 comes along, we've got ourselves caught in a little bit of a conundrum.
So here's the conundrum. If an officer, for example, is talking to a victim of domestic violence under SB 4, they would have to ask that victim to show them their papers. The El Paso police are afraid that forcing their officers to do ICE's job will make people stop trusting them, stop letting them know when there are drug deals or any other illegal activity. They say that enforcing SB 4 makes it very difficult to do their job. Plus, if they don't enforce it, officers can be fired or even charged with a misdemeanor. And so the county of El Paso filed suit against the state of Texas over the bill. Their argument? Their job depends on trust. And requiring El Paso law enforcement to help step into the role of immigration officers corrodes that trust. On top of all that, Flores says law enforcement here can't comply entirely with SB 4. Back in 2006, the county of El Paso settled a federal lawsuit, and as part of the settlement, El Paso County adopted a new policy where police officers can't ask citizens about their immigration status.
Because now it's like, well, you know, you've got the settlement that we agreed to, and then you've got this new law that says this is what we're supposed to do, and we're stuck somewhere in the middle.
So in other words, whatever El Paso County law enforcement does, they'll be in trouble. If they refuse to follow SB 4, the state could take away their funding. If they start pulling people over and asking them about their immigration status, they could be sued again.
But there's a bigger issue at play here, and one that extends beyond policy. It's at the heart of the city's identity as a border community.
We have a very interdependent relationship with our sister city, Ciudad Juarez. There's an old saying, when Juarez sneezes, El Paso catches a cold.
That's Veronica Escobar. She's the county judge here in El Paso. And we meet her on her front porch of her house with cicadas loudly chattering all around. She's really well-versed in the particular relationship that Ciudad Juarez has with El Paso. It's this close relationship, Escobar says, that makes some local officials balk at the idea that more enforcement along the border is actually needed.
When you see the hysterics that are coming from Washington, D.C. and from other parts of the country with regard to the border and border security, it is very frustrating. Our own governor, on the stage during a Republican debate, claimed that there were bombs going off on the streets of El Paso, which was just false, could not be further from the truth.
Escobar says SB 4 threatens the social fabric of the community here.
By eroding the relationship that exists between law enforcement and the immigrant community, we all know that's the target. We all know the motivation behind this is racism.
And according to some in El Paso, even before the proposal of SB 4, immigration enforcement efforts have escalated in the Trump era. There have been reports of ICE agents entering courthouses and other areas once deemed off-limits, what the DHS refers to as sensitive locations. Recently, a woman was removed from an El Paso County courthouse while filing a protective order.
In some respects, it feels like the legislature wants to fundamentally change our DNA and who we are.
They now can go into courthouses or start arresting witnesses or victims of abuse. I mean, that was always not in the table.
That's Fernando Garcia. He's the executive director for a nonprofit called the Border Network for Human Rights. It's been around for more than 20 years. It's late in the afternoon when we arrive at their offices. 50 people crowd into a meeting room to discuss plans for an event protesting SB 4. I ask him what he makes of the stories of ICE agents removing people from these so-called sensitive locations.
The perception of our communities is that the raids have already started. If ICE cannot be prevented from entering the courthouse, I mean, they can enter my home. Children, we're talking about the potential deportation of their parents.
So community advocates like Garcia argue that SB 4 will foment panic, feed fear of police in general, and therefore make cities less safe. Also, it's just causing confusion. The El Paso Police Department says it already cooperates with immigration agents.
Commander Flores, who you heard from earlier, says that El Paso has always honored ICE requests to hold individuals in their jails. And they'll hold someone up to 48 hours if federal agents want to interview that inmate. Flores says that the El Paso Police Department has a long history of cooperating with ICE, with Border Patrol, and with other federal immigration agents. So he says it's not about not being a team player.
It might seem, you know, looking at you with your sheriff's badge and your patches, your sheriff's office patches, and it might seem that people say, wait a second, why is Commander Flores not supporting the law of the land?
Every community has its set of dynamics. And El Paso, being a border community, first and foremost, we're not a sanctuary city. We've always come forward and cooperated with federal law enforcement when it comes to the enforcement of immigration law. But we were very, very clear in defining that line, and that's your responsibility as a federal agency. You handle that. We're going to handle the public safety aspect of our community. We've got people who come across the border to work. On both sides of the border, we've got several people from El Paso who go to Mexico, and a lot of people don't take that into consideration either.
And that's actually what we saw, Jonathan, as we spent a couple of days in El Paso. I mean, these two cities are inextricably linked.
Sort of reminds me, Maria, of what Judge Escobar said about that old saying in West Texas, when Juarez sneezes, El Paso catches a cold. It's almost like these two cities share one heartbeat. And most of the people we spoke to for this story would like to keep it that way.
Thanks to Jonathan Hirsch for his reporting on that story. So far in this episode, Fernanda Chavarri and I have been taking a close look at how the immigration enforcement system has changed under the Trump administration. But even though some strategies might be different, the system itself is basically the same.
Except for one thing, a new office.
Thank you for calling the Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement Line, or VOICE line, at U.S.
This is the hotline for VOICE, which stands for Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement. It's a new addition to ICE. It was established to, quote, fulfill President Trump's commitment to help people affected by criminal activity perpetrated by criminal aliens, end quote.
And this commitment has been a key point for Trump since he was a candidate. Like at the Republican National Convention, when he featured families who had lost a loved one to a violent crime committed by an undocumented immigrant.
One more child to sacrifice on the order and on the altar of open borders.
This gave Trump a big boost with some of his base. But on the flip side, human rights activists have said this rhetoric sends the message that all immigrants are criminals.
So, what exactly does this VOICE office do?
B-A-R-B-A-R-A-G-O-N.
That's Barbara Gonzalez. She's the director of the ICE Office of Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement.
What makes this office unique is the immigration information that a victim witness coordinator or someone at police department is not in a position to give.
What she means is that if you're the victim of a crime committed by someone here illegally, you can call VOICE, give them the name of the immigrant, and they'll ask you to swear under penalty of perjury that you are a victim, witness, or legal representative of a victim. Besides that, there are no other requirements. You don't have to present any police records. Then they'll tell you which immigration detention center they're in, when their next court hearing is, and whether or not they've been deported. Why would the victim need to know the details and immigration file of somebody if that's not why they're being arrested or are in jail?
So that's really a question, Fernanda, that you need to ask the victims. I can tell you, I've had many victims say that for a long time, they have not had a voice. And for the first time ever, they can at least obtain information that they would not have had in the past.
I asked Barbara about people just calling in to report suspicious activity or crimes committed by people here illegally.
The intent of this office is to help victims, not for reporting any crime.
The VOICE office is staffed with about 20 people who were already doing what Barbara calls community outreach for ICE, so no new hires. But what I still didn't know was how this office was different from the help that victims of any crime already have available. For example, local and state agencies that have survivor support groups or that help people navigate the legal system, what resources are different?
So we have victims assistance specialists. They are able to identify services in their local communities that people that are calling us have asked for. And you're absolutely right, Fernanda. There are these resources that are provided to victims at local levels. However, we have had victims that have called us who, in some cases, just had trouble getting certain services.
There's also a way to register online and access the same kind of information. Information that Barbara says was already public and anyone who knew where to look could find.
The very first thing that came to mind when I heard about VOICE was horror, quite frankly.
That's Grace Meng, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
This is a tactic that we've seen used by abusive governments around the world to scapegoat foreigners as bringing in crime as being the cause of a society's problems.
Grace says that the VOICE program is designed to feed xenophobia because it focuses on the crimes committed by a specific group of people, in this case, immigrants.
I think what's really quite sad is this, that many victims of crimes are actually immigrants themselves. I see the administration saying with one side of its mouth that it cares about victims of crimes, and then I see a real disdain for other kinds of victims of crimes.
And that's what makes something like the VOICE office so controversial. According to many studies, immigrants as a whole commit less crime than native-born U.S. citizens. So for people like Grace, this seems like a political move, something to please Trump's base rather than solve a real need.
We have already seen a rise in hate crimes around the country, and it's disturbing to think that the government itself is promoting inaccurate information about how immigrants cause crime.
And Maria, throughout my reporting for this episode, I picked up on a sense that ICE agents have been given more authority to sort of arrest now and ask questions later. And now that they've expanded who is a priority for deportation, there's also a sense that there's not much of a difference between an undocumented immigrant who's a drug dealer or a dad who's been working here in landscaping for decades.
And all of this is just in the first 6 months of the Trump presidency.
I mean, Trump did promise to get tough on immigration, and for now, he seems to be delivering on most of that promise.
But what he hasn't delivered on yet is the deportation part, the mass deportation of millions of immigrants. So until he gets there, immigrants, undocumented or not, are left wondering if or when that will happen. And nothing feeds fear more than the unknown. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Fernanda Chavarri, Marlon Bishop, Antonia Cerejido, Jeannie Montalvo, Julia Hsu, Zakiya Gibbons, and Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our interns are Nicola Acevedo and Alejandra Martinez. And if you enjoyed the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement of knowledge and understanding, by funds granted from the Charles H. Revson Foundation. The statements made and views expressed, however, are solely the responsibility of the author. And Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm a little voice that comes out of nowhere.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, President Trump has been talking a lot lately about the gang MS-13.
MS-13 is particularly violent. They don't like shooting people because it's too quick. It's too fast.
We take a deep dive into the story behind the gang. That's next time on Latino USA.